So what I'm going to talk about is the value of functions, some introduction to the elemental localization properties, and some explicit construction. The work was done with Zoya Pawlowska and myself when both of us were postdocs in Ole Anderson's group in the good old days. Zoya has since secretly moved to Israel without telling anybody, but when first Ole asked me to give this talk, I was a little bit hesitant, you know, this was done in 88 after all, and I had forgotten, I had no transferences and so on. But after Kurt Schoenhammer revived his talk from 1982, I was not feeling too bad. So this is a random picture I picked up from the web. This is, I guess, these two guys can pass for Ole and myself in some approximation. this is the basic reference from this work, and I warn you that I have not thought too much about the one-year function since then, although I have passively followed the literature and refereed a bunch of papers. So that's all my thinking on that.
So you know who to complain to.
Okay, so the basic ideas of the Wannier functions, it was came in a famous paper by Wannier in 1937. I have a little bit to do with him. After my PhD in the early 80s, I was so fascinated with his work that I wrote him a letter for a postdoc position. And he wrote me back in the handwriting, you know, saying that he's retired a long time ago and he can't help me. But anyway, so these are orthonormal localized functions that span the same space of eigenstates of a band or a group of bands, okay? So this is the standard block function here, some kind of periodic function here multiplied by a phase factor, and then you could have an arbitrary phase which does not depend on space, okay? And you can Fourier transform and get your one-year functions, okay? And you see that if you just take just make u equal to 1, so it's your just plane waves, you get a delta function. So one-year functions are localized functions. And if you construct them out of the block functions, it will not be exactly like delta function, but hopefully some kind of localized state, okay? So this is a simple example of a one-year function. Here, this is some kind of a S band, and this is a block function at k equal to 0. You will have, these are individual S states, and of course, for different k's, you'll have different phases. And you construct a one-year function, the object will look something like this, okay? And then, of course, the question is what kind, how much you can localize it, and so on and so forth. So, some good points. Well, nice to think about these states in terms of localized states, that I don't have to convince anybody here on that, you know, for copper, D, oxygen, P, and things like that. And these are natural way to build models for correlated electron systems, okay? For example, Hubbard models and things like that, okay? The bad points, this is a real bad point, is that they're not uniquely defined, okay? And the uniqueness is not trivial. The one-year functions can vary in shape and range quite drastically, depending on how you choose the phase factors of your block functions, okay? Block functions, on the other hand, are pretty well defined. No matter who computes them, you come up with the same thing. The one-year functions are very different. So this is an issue that really needs to be solved before we can really use it. And in my opinion, this is really the reason why the physicists have a love-hate relationship, you know, with one-year function. If you go back to the literature, you'll find that in a bunch of 10, 15 years, people do a lot of work, they forget, they come back, and so on. So, because they have really not been able to come up with some unique definition of these things. How to build them? Well, there are several methods. I'll just pinpoint, you know, what they are. I'm not going to go into any details, just give you the ideas here in this talk. Half an hour, I cannot do much more than that. So there's Cohn's variational method, okay? In that method, basically, you realize that when you construct a one-year functions, they are going to be, their energy is going to be the average of all the bands, okay? Because all your one-year functions are identical. So for example, if you construct the one-year function for silicon valence band, their energy will be some average sp3 energy, okay? So the idea was that, well, you basically make some functions out of the s and the p orbitals, and variationally minimize their energy. You'll never be able to go below the E average band, okay, using those S and P functions, right? So that was the idea. This one was implemented by Ken and Ken in 1978. If you look at our paper, it's quite cumbersome with a lot of numbers and nothing. And actually, this was the paper that we looked at and said, you know, I mean, we don't understand the problem. I mean, what's the big deal? So we basically tried to use the other idea of basically adding up the block functions with a particular choice of phase, okay? That's what I did in 88, and recently Marjorie and Vanderbilt, they have implemented a similar procedure for plane waves. I will show some results from that also. And of course, now Ole has his NMTO, that his work still in progress, and probably this can also give him a way of constructing the Vanier functions.
Because he can ask you cones work, so I mean this minimization of the energy, I would say the energy is the band energy, but that is of course a point of view that you have a complete set of functions in the fund that you projected out
right.
States. You, but what Cohn tried to do was also what I would call direct generation of Vanier functions. He was trying to
Right. So but this was a different idea, expressed in a different paper. Okay. And was implemented by Ken and Ken for silicon and also by Andrioni for hydrogen. She was the first one to actually implement that. And then after that, the experience for that is just too cumbersome to do it. So, okay, so of course, the localization is the reason why we're interested in the Vanier function. So what can we say mathematically about this localization of these things? Okay, people involved are Cohn, 1959, actually, it's a beautiful paper. I knew this paper much before I knew his density functional papers. De Cloisieu and Nenciu. What Cohn was able to prove in a quite nice paper was that for every band in one dimension, okay, I'll come to three dimensions in a second. A lot of these theorems are exact in one dimension, they don't go over to three dimensions. There exists one and only one Vanier function which has all three of the properties. Okay, that's real, is symmetric or antisymmetric, falls off exponentially. It's unique. Okay? Nenciu has been able to slightly generalize that. This is his theorem. If block functions are differentiable in K space and analytic in a complex neighborhood of K, then the Vanier function falls off exponentially. So this is kind of contained in there. So if you make it real and symmetric, it is going to fall off exponentially. This is a much more recent work. Well, the exponential localization, this one is related to the analyticity of the band structure in the complex K space. Okay, this is a picture of a complex K space and the band structure in it. You have the real K axis here, imaginary K axis and the real part of energy. And what is shown here are just the band structure as a function of real K. The band structure for imaginary K is not shown, or you know, to make the picture intelligible. Now, if you go to the complex K space, what happens is that these bands are connected. Okay, so if you, for example, if you go in the complex K space from that point on, then you will be able to climb up to that band if you go through the branch point. Okay, and this branch point will turn out to determine how well you can localize these Vanier functions. So the decay constant is related to how far the branch point is in the complex K plane, and if you do some simple hand waving kind of mathematics, A will turn out to be roughly proportional to the square root of the gap. Okay. Now the question is, one can ask is, if I don't demand this reality and symmetric, am I able to make little better Vanier functions which are more localized? Okay. The answer is no. Okay. You cannot make it any better. They are exact theorems in 1D. Okay, this basically comes from there. If your complex K point here, if your branch point, if it comes closer and closer to the real axis, your Vanier functions are more and more delocalized. Okay? In the limit that the bands touch, okay, mathematically speaking, that point has now moved to the real axis, you cannot have exponential localization. Right? Okay, so this is just a simple example that actually Warren gave the other day. You just have, there's no exponential localization if you have so touching bands. It's a very simple case. Energy goes like k square. The Vanier functions fall off as one over x and one over sine over x and so on.
Sorry, because we are taking just one band?
Just one band. This is for the free electron and the simple cubic lattice.
So if you use both bands to build that.
Well, then you have something here.
Okay.
So you can never get rid of the gap in this case. Yeah. If this was not touching, you'll be able to exponentially localize it. All right. So now, if you do a variational calculation a la Kohn to obtain exponentially localized wave function for this case, your energy bands near the zone boundary will not be properly reproduced. Okay. Because by assuming a certain exponential fall off, you are in some sense injecting a band gap there. Okay. If you cut it off at r equal to r0, the Vanier function, the bands within a certain distance of the Billon zone will also not be reproduced. So you can't really get around this thing. Okay. Of course, the question is, do you really want exponential localization and all? That's another issue.
Do you really want those kings?
Sorry?
Oh, you really want all those kings?
Yeah. Okay, so that was in one dimensions. Now, what do you know in three dimensions? Well, quite a bit, but you know, not too much. Okay, if you have an isolated single band in one dimension, then also you can prove that exponential localization is possible. It's one band. The problem comes for the more interesting case of the composite bands, okay? Silicon valence bands or copper d oxygen p bands and that kind of thing. So for multiple bands, De Clausewitz, quite early on, was able to prove that in many cases, the problem with this many, if block functions are analytic in the domain of some space, then the corresponding Vanier function falls off exponentially. Okay? Unfortunately, whether your particular bands belongs to this class of the sum cases is not easy to figure out without studying the analyticity property of all your band structure. Okay, so the working conjecture, well, you have several choices. You can now switch your field and go to the math and try to prove these things. People have spent 10 years studying anything. Or you wait until the mathematicians prove something. Or you have a working conjecture that for all cases of isolated groups of bands with gaps in it, isolated meaning gaps from the rest of the bands, exponentially localized Vanier function exists, although proof for it has not been found yet. That's a decent conjecture. I mean, you cannot work if you don't have that. Okay, now some calculus. Yeah?
I think I remember that physically what was the reason for this problem with the localization was that you could not follow in terms of, if you have crossing bands, if you take the symmetry, let's say, of your S and P bands, after the crossing, you just don't know where you belong when you come after the crossing. And
I'll come to that point, actually.
Because basically, physically, you have then this kink feature, and this gives, of course, in K-space, if it's a kink, gives us the long-range behavior in R-space. But then you would argue that the touching case of two bands is really different, and you might be able, if they touch, to still construct an exponential 1A function. Is this the case?
Symmetry will also mess it up. I mean, I'll let me come to that point. I'll talk about that. Yeah. Some very sketchy calculational details. So with that conjecture, we then proceed to compute the Vanier function for 3D composite bands. Remember, at that time, people were basically doing the Kohn's variational principle, and we didn't understand why you need that. Okay. So as example, we just took the valence bands of silicon, the standard test case. So we wanted to stick to whatever is well known in the one dimensions. Okay, we wanted a reality of the wave functions, and we wanted symmetry. Okay, we wanted maximum symmetry compatible with the 3D bands. Probably this has to go to do with the one on Hanke's point here. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Okay, let me just show you about this sp3 bond orbital that everybody knows. You first make the out of the s and p orbitals, you make the directed bonds, and then you make the bond orbital by making a bonding combination of these directed bonds, that's your bond orbital. This is a pretty important point to communicate to you. This is the silicon valence bands with all the symmetries. Okay, so you want to have a particular symmetric wave function that spans all this point, okay? At gamma, let's focus on the gamma point. Okay, gamma point, I have to have gamma 1 and gamma 25 prime. You have your 1-year function, you have to come up with an object that has exactly those irreducible representation of the point group, okay? Well, silicon S, of course, you can do eliminate that on finger counting, right? That goes like gamma 1 plus gamma 2 prime, and so on. You go to silicon-silicon bond, the bond orbital that I showed you, that goes like exactly gamma 1, gamma 25 prime, exactly like that, okay? You go to silicon-silicon antibond, it has something, some other symmetry, okay? So you want something that has the symmetry of the silicon-silicon bond. In fact, it has to have the symmetry of the gamma 1 irreducible representation of the D3D point group, okay? Now, this is a point that's probably important a little bit, I don't know. If you, for example, go at delta point, okay, you find that the same silicon-silicon bond will span exactly those three symmetries, delta 1, delta 3, 2 prime, delta 5, same as X point and same as Z point and so on, all right? Now, it turns out that if you can find an object, okay, that spans the proper representation of the gamma point, it is guaranteed to span the rest, okay? And that has got to do with a paper by Zach, who knows a lot about group theory, and he would call this some kind of continuity chord, okay? That if you know, if you are able to reproduce the gamma point, provided these bands don't touch and move up and there is some intersection with something else, all right? So we know in advance that we need to compute an object that has the gamma 1 symmetry of the D3D group, okay? If you don't pay attention to that, stuff like degeneracy, etc., will be messed up, okay?
So the point is that your local orbital has to transform as the block wave function at the gamma point.
Of the gamma, right.
Yeah, but it's sort of obvious, no? I mean...
Yeah.
And once you do that, then right. what do you...
Okay.
Because it's not clear to me what are the other things. I mean, in a Vanier state, a Vanier state is like a local object.
Right.
So it's like something which lives at the gamma point. It has the same symmetry as something in the gamma point. It doesn't have the symmetries in a special line, which is less.
Right, but it has to have this. It has to span also these symmetries there too.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if I take my SP3 bound or whatever one-year function you have,
yes,
you have a n number of object, right?
Yes.
And so one object, it has to have the that particular representation. Okay, so if I have an object like that, SP3, those my three bonds, I'll have to, if I have, you know, it has to have threefold symmetry and so on. Okay? And this particular object will span all the required symmetry there. Okay? If you create an object which has different symmetry, it will be messed up. The rest of the points.
Just one orbital on many sides inside the unit cell. So there is some kind of relation between the orbitals in different sides, I think.
I see.
You are thinking just in terms of having many orbitals on the same side.
Right.
Where instead you can have also.
This way. Okay. All right. Should come back. But it went back to the next slide.
So actually, this is not sufficient. I mean, suppose, I'm sure that some F states which transform according to gamma 2, 5 prime.
All right, I can
you
make it.
Two, three of those F states.
You are absolutely right.
The S state,
you are absolutely right. Nonsense. Yeah, you are absolutely right. In fact, that paper discusses that too. Your empty SP3 or bonding orbital has exactly same symmetry. Your empty sphere. SP3 orbitals will have the same symmetry. But of course, you know, Pauling told us long ago that, you know, empty states and all that. Okay.
The point of this Vanier function is a little bit like coming after the act. I mean, for a practitioner, you know sort of what atoms you have and what orbitals you need to feed in, and the question is only you know how to get a complete basis set and all, and then project out. This is sort of presenting you with some bands, which by the way only exist in a certain space group and blah, blah. If
right.
you cook it in the atoms smooth, all of this stuff is gone. And still, the chemistry remains more or less, so I think it is
yeah.
a bit academic.
Yeah, it is. But we have to go through all this careful analysis in order to construct it.
But I have a question.
And I have more analysis, actually, following this.
As Oli explained this morning, the wave functions or the Vanier states are centered on atoms. In silicon, we just have those bands, and we would like to produce something which is centered on the bond, right?
Right.
So you're going to produce four objects, four states, right?
Because centered on the four bonds, right? Centered on the four bonds.
And
it will
know by itself that they have to be
centered
around the bond.
That's coming from the symmetry, right?
But the difference between this morning, the way we do it, it doesn't matter whether you have diamond structure or something else or whatever. It will sort of, the Hamiltonian will decide.
Yeah, but
in this case, you have to have this symmetry. The symmetry is less.
Here.
You will never produce something which is centered on the bond.
That's what I showed you.
No,
they
did.
Eventually, you have to.
Yeah, and it came out. Yeah.
By taking linear combinations, I mean, our NRTOs are always centered on the symmetry.
No, but then I symmetrize. I say, I have this particular, I get out the Hilbert space of the four dimensional Hilbert space. And that spans the Hilbert space, correct, but they're not orthogonal, they're not this or that, but they span the Hilbert space. And then I say, I know this is diamond structure, so let me symmetrize them. And then I make SP3, because then they stay in this direction. And that SP3 orbital then looks like exactly, or is the bond orbital.
Okay, so this is selling some more stuff to the converter, just showing that the SP3 bond orbital has a major contribution to the silicon band, because you only, at the symmetry point, from symmetry you can eliminate the antibond state and so on. So you can go and figure out along the various point what is the contribution of the silicon bond orbital and antibond orbital. Okay, so in this case you find that for silicon you have roughly 72% of contribution coming from the bond orbital, and 4% coming from the antibond orbital. Okay, if you actually, this is an interesting thing. If you look at these numbers here, this is the amount of bond, amount of antibond. The bond order in chemistry is defined as B minus AB. You see that as you come from carbon to silicon to germanium to alpha tin, the B minus AB character progressively decreases. Okay. In fact, if you go to the lead in the hypothetical diamond structure has become so weakened that it would much rather form in the FCC structure. That's a point aside. So the point is, I have 72% silicon bond character. Okay, bond orbital character. For the valence bands, so I can hope to, so by so of these, how much character is centralized at the central bond orbital is not clear. It will come from stuff like the gap and stuff like that.
I'm sorry. This is now different definitions. In the definition of the Lanier function for the valence band, which is an isolated set of bands. It has 100%. If the bond orbital is equal to the Lanier function, and I think that's
which it is not,
which is possible.
Right.
In your construction, it is not.
Right.
You construct out of some
orthogonal basis set.
Some orthogonal basis set, which you happen to have bonding and anti-bonding that is symmetrizing it, and then you look how much is in each band.
Right.
Whereas the Lanier type procedure would probably proceed the other way and project out of the valence band an object. Which has the symmetry properties of the bond orbital, and by definition
What do you mean by Vanier type construction?
Sorry?
What do you mean by Vanier type construction?
Well, you would project it out, you say, I have this band, and I now want the orbital of the Hilbert space which spans this band.
Yeah, that's
and
what
I would like them in a symmetrized way.
Right, that's what is being done, I guess. Let me go back actually. Calculation details. Okay, so I was kind of here. So basically saying that we chose all that so that again, we want to stick closely to the established idea is 1D. You know, in 1D, if you follow this procedure, you'll have an exponentially localized state. Okay. In 3D, nobody has proved any theorem, but our working conjecture that if you did that, you would come up with an exponentially localized state. Okay, now we are quite careful those days. I'm sometimes not as careful these days, but anyway. So here, you compute the psi k in the 148th of the Boulogne zone and construct the psi k in the full zone from symmetry. Okay, so that our symmetry doesn't get messed up. The choice of phase factor. So we basically choose it such that the bond orbital projection is real and positive. So you have your block waves. You project into the bond orbital and you choose the phase factor such that this contribution is real and positive. Okay, there is, you can know you cannot increase the amount of bond orbital here anymore. You're just adding everything with a real and positive number. Okay, so this is the only way to get the maximum sp3 bond orbital at the central site. Okay.
Can it have kinks as function of k then, if you force it to be positive?
Which one?
Condition for the choice of the phase.
Can it have kinks? Even can the part? Oh, you mean the choice of the phi k? No. No. I mean, you have to choose the your phase such that it is kind of continuous, and it is automatically kind of done that way. So the block functions, if you actually looked at it from k to k, it will be kind of smooth and differentiable and so on.
Yeah, you need that.
So these were your money. I'll show you in a second.
Okay. What you were talking about. Those were defined such that they had the maximum possible value on.
Right. Now this is just a test of convergence. So this is the contribution of the psi cells, where the total amount of silicon charge density in a particular cell. Okay, so this is all in a cell, and then we studied the convergence. As you see, we did a quite careful thing, and this is 2,000 points in 1/48th of a zone. That's 10th of a million k points. A million sounds better. Okay, so and our things are quite well converged. So this is how it looks. After all is said and done, looks quite beautiful, it's centered at the bond orbital. It's a little bit negative lobe here, and it has a little bit of amount of charge density on the other silicon atoms. Okay, as it must, if it is exponentially localized and it's not totally localized on the same site. So this is the charge density, the same thing, but looking at the numbers, I guess the only thing I want to take a look at it is the central cell contribution. I have 72% of the bond orbital character that could come to the central cell, okay, and only 54 comes there, and you cannot increase it the way we constructed it. Okay, so and you can just add up all these things how it is and so on.
Where does that 72 come from?
72% is the total sp3 bond orbital contribution in the silicon valence bands in the Buffington orbital base itself.
With the bond orbital defined how?
Just sp3 plus sp3. So you have the s and p. You begin with s and p. You rotate your Hilbert space to sp3. You rotate it again, your bond orbital, antibond orbital, and so on. So your basis set now has sp3 bond orbital, sp3 antibond orbitals, d orbitals, empty sp d orbitals. That's the basis set now. Okay, so out of that, 72% in this particular representation. I mean, this is general anyway for any orthogonal orbitals. Okay, so out of that, you can put 54% in the central bond. Yeah.
Since the 72 came up again, and Oli asked about that, or was the thrust of your remark that maybe should have been 100% if you
it's
would
a matter
struck
of definition.
The Sanyi function
seems
in a different
to be
way.
Making
well, if
Sanyi has a definition. He has something which is called a Vanya function. We all agree on what the Vanya function is. But that thing he is construct out of his basis set, which is his or my invention, whatever. He has some basis set to start. And that basis set has sp orbitals and so on, and that basis set he constructs bonding and antibonding orbitals, and they are not the same as the Van Meer. That's why he makes this, because they were sort of constructed in some way. In my modern way, they would be identical, but in his way of describing it, they are not exactly the same, because he has a bigger basis set. He has some more orbitals here and there.
And if they were the same, would that 72 be 100%?
Yeah. If you define the object I showed you as your sp3 bound orbital, it's 100%.
Yeah.
So, okay. How about the localization properties? Well, with our working conjecture.
Can I still ask?
Yeah.
I could, probably this is identical, in your scheme, construct the Vanier functions out of these isolated four valence bands.
Isolated?
Yeah, I mean,
so four different Vanier functions.
In the sense that you have a gap between the other bands up and the lower bands below. So you have four valence bands and four, let's say, conduction bands isolated. But I could also have the crazy idea that I take the eight bands and construct the Wangerian functions.
Yeah.
Would there be a difference in your
localization properties will be different.
Why? Because I mean
because the gaps are different.
Yeah, but the gap is
That is increasing. If you increase, you stay instead of taking four, you take eight.
Yeah, so this is your valence, right?
Then you just get
and this is your conduction.
Then
you have bands here. See, if you have bands here, the localization property is going to be controlled by that.
Yeah, but if I have a gap, if I take the gap into account, I have four valence bands, a gap, and four.
Right, exactly. So this is a four valence bands. So the localization of the Wangerian function here is depends on this gap and that gap. Right? Localization of this Wangerian function will depend on this gap and no gap here.
That will kill your
exponential localization.
Something like that. Let's assume that we have two bands only. One is just one is just separated from the rest. So you can walk just with
like
one
that.
Band or with two bands. Depend on you. The process will give you different Wangerian function. This is the question. Okay.
Even those
take that you have just two separate bands.
Like here.
Just two.
Okay.
And then you can just build up the Wangerian function with just one band, because this is separated.
Right.
Or you can build up the Wangerian function with two bands. Are they similar or different?
Oh, they'll be different because your symmetry is different. I mean, for example, in the case of silicon, you'll find S and P. Okay, or sp3 bond and sp3 antibond.
Okay. This is again academic. Of course, if you have two isolated bands, you can do the Wangerian function for the lower one and the one for the upper one, and now you can make any linear combination out of those. And if these two bands did not cross it, you will have the sum of the two. That's it. But now, in reality, of course, if you look at silicon, that conduction band is connected up to God in the upper world, like the first picture Sashi showed of this free electron-like thing, and there's a copper cut up there. So in reality, you very seldom have bands which are not connected to something else. So in reality, you will actually be allowed to the wireless and quite reproduce it.
Go back to the original question. If you have two isolated bands, which are coupled and have some of the same character, you can form 28 functions out of two bands separately, or you can take the two bands together, and you have the freedom to take any unitary transformation at each K point between the block states to form a 1E function. So you have the freedom to make them a little bit more localized, or more delocalized, or some other change them in some other way. So there's freedom there in that.
Yeah, of course, if you have two isolated bands with no band around, in principle, you are able to make a Wangerian function if you combine both of them with infinite localization, because there's no band gap up or below. So you'll be better off in that situation to make a Wangerian function for both the bands combined if you have nothing below or above, if you want localization.
But this is, again, to some extent, on example, will show that this is not trivial from a plane wave point of view, but otherwise is. Because let's say you have a bonding band and an anti-bonding band. The Wangerian function for the lower band is bonding, it's sitting on two sides, it's a hydrogen molecular solid, and the one on the upper one is also sitting on two sides, it's anti-bonding. However, by making the sum of the difference between them, you will be localized on the one atom or on the other. So that is localized.
Okay, so we wanted to look at the localization property because that's what I wanted to see, if you get exponential localization or not. And that depends on the complex band structures, and Y.C. Chang had just computed, using some empirical tight binding method, the complex band structure in the K-space for limited sets. So we kind of took that as a guidance. And so he basically looked at two different directions and found branch points and those imaginary points. If we assume that there is no other branch points in the K-space in this neighborhood, then the Wangerian function should fall off as exponential minus d to the power d over 0.64a. A is the silicon lattice constant. Well, this is what we found. Okay. This is our function plotted at different points, different cells, as a function of distance. And it looks like e to the power minus d over 0.81a. This is log scale here, and the function. And in fact, even while I don't want to put too much emphasis on that particular number, but the error even goes in the right direction, because the empirical tight binding method, you have the proper band gap. Band gap is larger. In the LDA, the band gap is lower. So your one-year function will not be as localized. But anyway, that's just a side comment. So looks like it's a good way of doing it. So I have to comment on this recent paper. So what do they do? They have the plane waves, of course. So it's not easy to look at localized states. Well, you start from the definition. Okay. Your U is the unitary matrix. You are allowed to modify it as much as you wish. So basically, you construct your U by steepest descent algorithm such that some expectation value of R square is minimized. Okay? Cannot be any more general than that. And of course, they call this maximally localized, which I don't like because our thing is maximally localized too in some sense. But anyway, what is involved is the minimization of a function in a few number times nk of space. Nk is the number of k points because this matrix is a number of k points, and then for each matrix, you need a few number of variables, you know, for your unitary matrix. Okay? So they use the grid of 8 by 8 by 8, about 500 k points. Okay?
This procedure varies, in principle, it varies the center of the one-year function.
Right.
As well as the spread.
That's a particular implementation because they started with a Gaussian and then they implemented it in a particular way. Right. So that you can come to the minimum in a reasonable manner.
If you do it for gallium arsenide, for example, you get an arsenic-biased center
for the function. Right. I don't think they don't really assume any Gaussian or anything. They start it out with something so that they're close enough to the minimum in the steepest descent algorithm so that you appear there quite easily, a little better. Well, the principle is also quite simple. Okay, so what do they find? Well, this is the same one-year function I showed you, and this is their one-year function. It looks pretty good, even with the negative lobes are there, and I mean, they don't have anything at the other atoms, but...
So what is the difference between the two constructions then?
One is our construction. We chose the U with some physical idea. We chose some particular value of U. Our procedure is basically equivalent to choosing the U on physical grounds, that 4x4 unitary matrix.
Physical ground?
The sp3 bounds and all that thing I went through, sp3 bound symmetry, and you know,
uh-huh.
So maximize the sp3 bound orbital. So that was the physical ground there. Here you just let your computer do your work and you guess a function which looks like a Gaussian or something, then you proceed from there. How about the localization property? They claim in their paper that they are not interested in it. Okay, but I think I don't really know why they did not do any more than 8³. Okay, because looking at the paper, it doesn't appear that it should be so difficult, but they only did 8³ k points, which basically amounts to 8³ is 500, 10k points in the irreducible 1/48th of the zone. This is our picture, so that will be right here. If I stuck to 10k points in the irreducible Billon zone, I'd be nowhere. I won't be able to see the localization property either. So I'm not surprised that they're not seeing any localization property, but also I don't understand why they cannot just increase the number of k points in the minimization procedure. All right, so that's what I was guessing. I didn't say that, but okay. So. What?
They went with special
K points? Special K, I think they used a regular mesh, standard mesh, yeah. And I don't think they... What?
Why should it take so much time? It's just empirical. I was interested. We tried with Nikolai when he was a postdoc. We tried to do lanthanum titanium oxide and just getting one wave function that takes...
That's a different story.
It just takes...
I don't understand. I mean, it cannot be that they're not interested in the localization. Come on, I mean, if you write several papers, I mean, you have to look at this. So I don't know.
You have to minimize the function of the
million variables. So the point is what they did in 1988 is just as good or probably even better. Anyway, this is just the last result I wanted to show. My time is up.
I don't know how it scales with the number. I mean, the more variables that you have to solve for, the longer it takes, and probably the scaling is like n³, where n is the number of variables.
Something related to this is that Postanak and some collaborators use this algorithm in the LAPW method for manganese oxide.
Okay.
and they quoted doing 2,000 iterations or something like this in this procedure to minimize. And I talked to Michelle, actually, after the first 20 or 30, it was still making little progress, but very tiny progress.
I see. So there could be some technical problem. Yeah.
2,000 iterations or something.
Yeah, I was guessing there must be some technical problem here. All you know, I mean, now they only code 8 cube in the full zone, which is modern day computer tiny. So yeah, but anyway, that really side comment here. So this is the how the 1 year function, the character. So here what I have done is integrated the charge density within a certain distance, and you see that the 1 year function really falls up slowly. You know, if you wanted to have 90% of the charge density, you have to go all the way to about 3 lattice constants of silicon. So it's an object that is kind of spread out. I mean, I would call it quite spread out, and you really can't do very much about it because of the localization properties. Okay, so I'm ready to conclude. Born-center 1 year function we constructed based on some physical choice of phase, and this is how we chose the phase. Exponential falloff was demonstrated. Yeah. And this is the most localized 1 year function in the sense that the central SP3 character within our LMTO SP3 bond is maximized. Okay, if you wanted to maximize some such local operator, necessarily the SP3 bond character will suffer because the way we constructed it, it was maximized already in the bond. So, issues and questions. Well, uniqueness. If you took another set of orthogonal orbital, maybe I'll get a little bit different one. Or should I maximize R square and or minimize R square? Those kind of issues that needs to solve. Of course, how universal is the method? I have only done it for silicon, and as you saw, I have forgotten it for so many years. So maybe it's time to look at some other interesting systems to see how this, if this works, and maybe get an idea about the nature of the localization and things like that. NMTO as a method of to compute one-year function, only already talked about a little bit. Maybe this has some hope. Of. My feeling, though, is that it will probably come up with similar type of computing time and all that. Then, of course, how to compute parameters such as U, etc., for model Hamiltonian. For example, can I develop a constraint density functional calculation where you constrain the number of electrons somehow in this one-year function? I don't know. And then, of course, 1 year function for non-isolated bands, it appears from all the mathematics in the literature that you will not have exponential localization there. But then, how crucial is really the lack of exponential localization? If I have 1 over R5, it's probably localized enough for our purposes. So that is something to think about. Well, thank you very much.
I think the first time I ever heard of Wannier functions was when I was trying to read Anderson's super exchange papers years and years and years and years ago. And in that, you probably remember the flow of that paper is how complicated it is to try to do super exchange if you look at all the individual atomic or chemical and so on and so forth. And so he introduces the scheme that he's going to do band theory by some scheme first. And then he's going to transform to Wannier functions, and he's going to use the Wannier functions to, and now he'll have an orthogonal basis which avoids certain problems with the sign of exchange integrals, and then now he's going to have a definition of the hopping parameters that includes the oxygen and so on and so forth. And the flavor was that by making this transformation to Wannier orbitals after doing band theory, he sort of avoided all problems of previous efforts to do super exchange. I mean, I think that's what he puts forth in the paper. So now it's 2002.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Could you really, I mean, first of all, how much correctness was there in the kind of sweeping character of, that he put forth there? Or is it, could you really do it? Could you actually calculate those things that he defined, and would it be unique? Was it just a way of presenting an idea and a way of looking at super?
No,
not really practical in hindsight.
No, I guess once you have a function, you can compute all those things. I mean, but the thing is, the real problem is, in my mind, is the uniqueness of it. You know, somehow, you want to comment?
Yeah,
I mean, that is the success story of this audience. We've been calculating tons of how big integrals and super exchange and exchange, and if you do it right, seems come out right. Now there is no, well, the uniqueness in the Hopping integrals. Well, the Hopping integrals are the Hamiltonian and the representation of the Van Leeuwen orbitals. But these things are unique because that's the Fourier transform of the band. So if you agree on what the band looks like, you Fourier transform it, and you get the Hopping integral. It doesn't depend on this.
But the breakers,
the answer is yes. This can we get mm-hmm. pretty we're good at that.
Yeah.
Now
that part you know how to do.
But the U parameter and such things that we calculate are bare. Which the Fourier functions are just basis set up. So to do the real physics beyond just Hopping parameters, right? Still work to understand
what. But Warren, I think the first thing you have to somehow come up with the uniqueness. I mean, you know, otherwise, even the bare U will be different.
Well,
the two different one your function, even your bare U will be different. I think in my mind, really, the uniqueness is something that we have to worry about and figure out. Is there, like in one dimension, we know there is a unique function. Three dimensions, we don't have enough experience.
You wrote down something in your last view map, which people mentioned in the past, is the orbital U1 the one that maximizes the value of U? Expectation value of 1 over R.
People have done that, yeah.
1 over R minus R prime.
That's right.
If there's any good physical reason for that.
Yeah.
I guess there is, isn't there?
Yeah, what we want to do.
That's what we would like to do. Well, that's going to give you, because that would give you the orbitals to use in a DMFT calculation.
Why?
Because the character of the approximation, when you do, basically in DMFT you're treating exactly the local interaction, and then you're treating in an approximate way the non-local part. So what you would like to do is you would like to maximize the pieces of the Hamiltonian that you treat exactly. What local means is the basis dependent statement, right? So you would like to adjust your basis so that the approximation given to you is good. You see, if your method doesn't depend on the basis, then you can do it in any basis you like. But LDA plus U or DMFT, they depend on the basis that you use. And what they do is they try to treat some piece of the Hamiltonian exactly, while the other ones are then approximately. So you would like the piece that you treat exactly to be as large as possible. So that's why you would like to maximize the U. But I didn't know how you formulate. Has anybody solved the corresponding Marzari Vanderbilt kind of problem for that kind of function now? Maximizing the U. I mean, just like they did. I mean, you write the functional and then you minimize with respect to the phases.
Not recently, but it seems like.
There are some works in the literature. The ideas are there, but I don't know how much numerically they did it.
No, but just formulate it precisely.
There's no problem. Can be done.
But I'm not sure that.
Why not?
Maximizing the orbital just to make your approximation look better.
Yeah.
No, it's not to look better. It's to approximate the exact result.
Optimization. It seems to me like your most physical orbital in some cases might not be the one that maximizes mm-hmm. you. I don't see the physical argument for that.
Again, I'm saying you're solving, think of doing model Hamiltonians, and you have a tool to treat some part of it well, while the other one you do mean fields. So then you want that to be as, you would like to choose your basis set so that's as large as possible.
Splitting the orbitals, basically.
Yeah.
You know, take the biggest part of these things into DMFT, and the rest you just do.
It seems to me if you would just choose a copper G orbital itself and not let it hybridize with neighboring oxygens, you'd get a much larger U. And in some sense, you'll be doing that part of the problem much better, except you're ignoring something which really drags your orbital out physically.
I have some pictures on that.
Yeah.
In any case, the problem of defining Banier wave functions by maximizing U, I mean, do you have a reference to that?
I have somewhere, yeah.
There's a reference in the Vanderbilt 97 paper, from chemistry. But I have not been convinced from Sashi nor from Warren. You all stress this on uniqueness. I have seen you coming up with several results which look very different. Each of you came up with a pretty localized guy, and I don't think I can get it more localized. And I have honestly not seen, if you're sensible and you do a good job on it, or you have a sensible person, then you do come up with something which I haven't seen either that much. Have you?
No. In fact, Wayne who will be here Wednesday, thinks this prescription of essentially projecting with a fixed phase positive sign onto local onto atomic orbital gives you essentially to maximize the
I mean, the Van der Waal problem is something you have if you first throw out the chemistry and start with plain waves, and then you have to resurrect the chemistry. But if you've understood that, and then because you get enthused about some nice operator things and things which live in one dimension or something, but really, honestly, in practical questions, I don't think there's so much to do. Or we could also throw it around. Let's take one of these Vanier orbitals that some people put out, and then maybe I can talk about it there, and then try to spread it out. Let's try to see, you know, you're allowed to go the opposite way. And spread it out if you start with someone. It's actually much easier than trying to construct all these blocks, these plain wave blocks.
It's interesting to see how you differs from one representation to another one.
But this is all.
Somebody
can say, I mean, one can.
You see how the variation of U as a function of localization.
You mean some numerical value of something?
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
Of
numerical
course.
Study, or how to get U for different many orbitals, which are local, basically more or less localized, but within a range of 20-30%. Is there some linear scaling or whatever?
I mean, I think it's much more important that in many of the cases we are interested in, we don't have isolated bands.
Right. And then that needs some more work. Yeah. But like I said, you know, I mean, maybe exponential localization is not such a big deal. I mean, if you have 1/6, it's good enough, maybe. But that issue needs to be examined. I mean, I think for each individual case, you need to examine that.
But if you are allowed to take a more than one orbital, say you're interested in this band, but you have allowed, as Warren said, or have pictures of here from the high CC, you take a three-band model, three orbitals, then each of these three are easily very localized. They are atomic-like. But the question is whether that is a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, no, yeah.
So you are saying you have three orbitals, but only one of the bands, which they can build, namely this antibonding cover oxygen orbit band, is the one you want a real good representation of. The other ones, you're more, and that then gets this whole discussion into be a discussion about minimal basis sets rather than being a discussion of Vanier orbitals. And I think that's a much more general and much more fruitful discussion, because the Vanier thing is very rarely in systems that you have these isolated bands.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I would like to see, you know, how your MMTO within that orbitals, how localized they become. I mean, it would be interesting.
Somebody study on function of the band gap and localization as a function of
the band gap. There are very few papers on this.
I mean, how does it scale?
You mean the actual numerical calculation?
Yeah,
I mean, analytically, you know, in the one band model, you know, square root of gap.
Three-dimensional.
Yeah, it also should go something similar. But, no, nobody has done it.
So when the band gap goes to zero, then you get completely
Then you have to be very careful to see, you know, how it goes and all that. So, right? Okay, thank you.
Five minutes.
Maybe we come tomorrow.
I mean, I can. I can.
We can go. Then.
Yeah. No, I can say something which adds on to what we just discussed. There.
Okay.
actually too much.
Oh, no, we don't need this.
Can we mount this in 5 minutes?
Yes.
Notice the
it's all.
So this is what I had. I'm not gonna do all of this. I will concentrate something on this value function discussion. So you will probably all here this morning. This is just a view graph to say that we construct these things out of one electron potential and there are various methods and there are ways to use that, but I'm gonna use these NMCOs which I almost got through this morning.
N equals zero
this morning, but you can imagine. Or you can come again another day and I'll make a new one.
These other people are going to make you take the limit n going to infinity. Sorry, n going to infinity limit.
Then it becomes a value function for isolated bands. Okay, so we have said this many times. We derive a single particle Hilbert space and this called Chern potential, and we say, what's it now? If we have isolated bands, the value functions, we've seen that, can be obtained from the block states, that's what we heard, so, and computed with any basis set. So my first few graphs have your all sorts of basis set. No matter which one you have, it is complete and nice, and you have an isolated band. Then you can calculate the Wannier function, and here I'm taking the 1 and the 0's unit cell. So I put this translation vector equal to 0, and then you have to integrate, as Sashi said, here over these 3k times your block functions times, if you have more than one band, then this is a unitary matrix goes in this orbital index here, and the U is a unitary matrix, and if there's only one band, it's just this easily like space factor, if there's one band. And the way it is chosen, as we said, are such that the Vs are localized or maximally localized, and this is done by projection on SU. If you make sure that this object here, if that is real and it's sitting in the zeros unit cell, then you get something which is pretty localized. And that's what people are doing. We can discuss details of exactly what to do, or what they should minimize our square. Now, I will give you examples of this, and then I'll come back to this here. So I will now drop all lots of things about my high CCs, tell you this high CCs, and just the trends just make you believe that Jim, we have all the trends in the Hopping interval for whatever 15, 20 families of high CCs seem to come out.
What if it was a system where you didn't know in advance the answers like we
these
were
are
talking
not answers. I know the TC max, but the Hopping intervals, I don't know. I know the loop. I tell you what they are, and we are waiting that many more people to use them. Okay, anyhow. So this is a situation. Well, maybe I'll come back to that. This is actually a situation where the band is not quite isolated. But let me first get on to Sasha's discussion and say, okay, here's the orbital. Four single layer mercury barium carboxide. And this is the one created with this NMCO method and the condition on it. So this spans the band. I will show you to what extent in a moment, but really, if you take that one, and make a block sum out of it, then it really spans this band. And the way it was constructed, as I said this morning, is really that it is just one orbital, cover a square minus y squared, and the bound, let's imagine it's a King partial wave, so it's a solution of one energy of Schrödinger's equation, and has a boundary condition that is pure cover a square minus y squared symmetry here, and at all the other cover sites, there is none of this symmetry. So it's confined by saying there is none of this symmetry out here. So have this orbital be orthogonal, then if you now try to choose another phase in the Wannier function, that would only spill some of this cover, some of this character out to this side here. Because it's saying the x squared minus y squared character in a Wannier orbital is conserved over all the sides. So therefore, if you put it all on the central side and none of the others, you can hardly do better. But now this thing is not orthogonal. This thing is not orthogonal to the one you get if you translate it over to the other sides. But it's easy, but it's quite orthogonal, I'll show you how. And here's now the orthogonal. If you do Lerdin symmetrized orthonormalization, you get this. So now you can see you have a new cover x square minus y square character sitting up on these sides here. And I should also say from this orbit, so what have we done about the rhythm? But let me first discuss this thing here. Now I will ask the question, could I, by feeding this back into the block functions, if you like, turn on these faces and get it more localized? Or said in other words, by now choosing this Vanier type phases, could I get rid of these little things here? Could I get it more localized? So that is the point of view. So I'm having a complete basis set here, which spans this band. And the localization came from this boundary condition that there be no such character on the side. I get this, I orthogonalize it, I symmetrically orthogonalize it, getting this one, and now I can just pose the question, the academic question. Could I, by choosing unitary transformations, get rid of this one and get it more localized? So that little exercise I will first do.
And still have it be orthogonal.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay.
That's the idea. So this is the question. And I
and now, the orthogonal one extends in all space, of course.
Yes, the formula is as you can see, the stops.
Additional one shell is.
Additional one shell? Or
yeah.
You see the question.
No, you see it.
No.
Yeah, I have a picture. I actually know. Maybe it's coming. The picture is coming. Okay, let me just show you. I mean, the non-orthogonal. I mean, just to tie up to one discussion. So this is copper and oxygen. The material that Warren talked about last week. The orbits look very much the same. It is given by the copper and the oxygen character, and it looks like that. But Warren's orbitals were molecules. Here you had this plaquette. You had one sitting out here in space and another one sitting over here. However, in the copper oxide, the oxygens are shared. This thing is the same oxygen, which when you put it over here. So whereas in Warren's case, there was essentially no overlap, if you like, or whatever. There is a lot, and that is what gives the different physics, of course. You get this 10-volt broad band, or 5, depending on whether you look at the sphere or one band, and then that is totally different than in the case where the two oxygen orbitals are orthogonal to each other, and you have bandwidths of millivolts, and you have bandwidths of volts. Okay, but you can do your copying integral, you can see all your overlap integral, and you can see that the overlap integral, of course, comes from here by putting these two oxygens on top of each other. That's basically what it is. And the orthogonal thing, what you do is now you weaken this thing here and you get something which takes it away. Now, how big is the overlap integral? Now, as a function of distance, that must be calculated right here, I'm afraid. So this is now, as a distance, these various overlap, so at the central side, I'm afraid it's not normalized to 1, maybe it's only, what is it, 0.7 or something, it's almost 1 here. And then I place the orbital at the nearest neighbor side, you see it's down by, it's a few percent of the diagonal path, but here, then it sort of goes a little bit, you know, each lattice point out in the 1, 1, 1, 0, 0 direction, it has some bit here, a little bit here, a little bit here. So the orthonormalization gets rid of this. So now I'm going to do some little math. So in this case, it's a one-band case. And I have my NMTO, original, not orthogonal. It's here. It has an overlap integral, which is a unit matrix, plus a little bit. The little O here, that's a non-orthogonality. And this is my matrix notation. If you write it out as an integral, it means that the orbital sitting at translation t with the one of t prime is going to be your delta t prime. And then this is O over here, which is, of course, translation invariant, so it depends on whether t minus t prime. So with this integral, this is short notation. And now I do symmetrical Lerdin orthogonalization, so I'm going to get chi orthogonal here. And in Lerdin, you take the overlap matrix to the minus 1/2. Defined in the way you simply expand it. So O to the minus 1/2, since this was small, as you say, it were percentages, this is just 1 minus this little o, the off diagonal part, 1/2 of the little o in the first circle. Just okay, and so that now means, now I'm going to use that this thing is, of course, permission, or I would say we use real orbitals. There's no reason to have complex orbitals in this case. So these objects are real, and that means that the little o is symmetric for the inversion of t minus t, or the inverse t minus t prime symmetric. So therefore, if I now write up in real space what is chi perpendicular, so I'm saying I'm taking the one which sits at the central side, so this is the non-orthogonal one, and then I simply multiply by this matrix 1 minus 0 to 1/2, and that's what I'm doing, and this now gives a sum over the lattice translations, and I now combine the one with t and the one with minus t, because I know that O is symmetric, so what it says, I'm going to have the central one, and then I'm taking a little bit here, and the same bit here, because O is symmetric, O of t is equal to O minus t. So what's important here is that O is a symmetric matrix and it's translational invariant. So this means that I'm going to take the same bit on the one side as the other. So if the orbital original, the non-orthogonal one, looks like that, what I'm going to add to this one is a little bit here. I'm going to subtract this and I'm going to subtract that. Subtract if O is positive, add if O is negative. But it's a symmetric thing which does this to it. So that's what this means. So I've used that O is a symmetric, that is a O is zero minus t. And now the question comes, can I use a unitary transformation, this phase, in k-space it would be this phase, to localize this orthonormal MTO beta? So I want to get rid of this thing again. Can I now use this thing to get rid of this? So how does it work? So now I'm going to look, this was the orthogonality, now I'm back and looking at the Vanier transformation. You have been used to looking at the Vanier from the point of view of Bloch space, and there, for one band, the unitary matrix U is just e to the I times a phase factor. If you write that up in real space, it will simply be that this U here is a unitary matrix, and it is also translational invariant. So here I'm saying that the U is a unitary matrix, it should satisfy this. Because it is also translationally invariant, the unitarity or the orthogonality of U sigma on this side from that is simply this folding integral here, U star t minus t prime times t sigma. That's the unitarity. And that is exactly the same as the phase factor in the other one. Now, those of you who knows that the power spectrum of white noise is, as a, if you have white noise, then the autocorrelation function is a delta function. So this thing is exactly equivalent to the thing that, so I can say another way, so that U of T is simply the Fourier transform of the phase of e to the I phi of k. I could also say another thing, had I taken my local orbital and make a Bloch sum of it and sticking that into this relation we saw again before, you get exactly this. So U is just that unitary transformation, and I want to use it in real space and not in k-space. But in real space, I cannot put in any U. I have to make sure that U is unitary, and for a translationally invariant operator, I have to keep this. Okay, fine. So, as we said, by construction, this thing was quite localized, and we therefore limit ourselves now to infinitesimal unitary transformation. That's also what Vanderbilt and other people do when they do Steve 50 cent, and as you say, these little bits out here were quite small. So what is an infinitesimal unitary transformation? As you all know here, U is equal to 1 plus something small u. And then the Hermitian conjugate, of course, 1 plus u dagger. And now I want the Hermitian conjugate to be equal to u to the minus first. This is a trivial expression, you probably have it sometimes. U to the minus first, and if I expand this one, then u to the minus first is 1 minus u. So good approximation. So what you get is that u dagger has to be equal to minus u. So in this case, you see this thing is anti-Hermitian. That means that the real part of this guy changed the sign, the imaginary part of it is the same. So u, and now it's translational invariant, so that means that u star minus t is minus u t. Now I can do this transformation, put it under the Vanier function, so the Vanier function, and now take all of this stuff, you can probably see. So when I'll do this U with this thing here, and I again can collect terms with T and minus T. So the Vanier function, that is a new one I want to construct. What I want to do is, of course, to turn on these little U's in such a way that I get maximum localization of this guy. So say again, this one got to be delocalized by the orthogonalization. I want to see whether I can compensate that again by choosing some little U here, which will do that for again. So if you write that up, what this thing is, now you can see I get a factor U of T on the one on the left-hand side, but, and then I get U of minus T, but U of minus T is equal to U star of T on the right-hand side. This is just the opposite. Before with the little O, the overlap matrix for Hermitian. This guy is anti-Hermitian. And the result of this is you can't make it. And I put them together on that to make it actually clear. So now I put the two transformations together. So I'm going to say my Vanier function was equal to orthogonal one times the unitary matrix. And but this one, this orthogonal one, was itself symmetrically orthogonalized by the chi. This is the localized non-orthogonal one times rho to the minus first. And this one is 1 plus u, so this whole matrix is 1 plus u minus o half. But this guy is anti-Hermitian, and this guy is symmetric. So if you stick that in and see what you get, then the Vanier function in terms of the localized non-orthogonal one is of course equal to the one on the left-hand side times O of T half minus U of T. These numbers, O of T is a real number, I can choose it. This one could be complex, I can choose it. But on the other side, I get O of T plus U star of T. So now I'm trying to choose this U of T, which could be complex, in such a way that this thing gets smaller and this thing gets smaller. If I choose it to be a real number, I will get a minus u of t here and a plus u of t here. I can't do it. The thing is not symmetric anymore. It adds here and it subtracts there. If I'm choosing u of t to be a complex number, well, then you add an imaginary part here, and you also add the same imaginary part here. The same symmetry is broken. There's no way by which you can do this. And it's also quite natural. The symmetric orthonormalization is symmetric in here and there, but to make it orthogonal or this unitary thing, or this thing is not super like that. So there's no way you can do that. And therefore, I would say we have constructed these NMTOs from the boundary condition. There'd be no cover x square minus y character out on these other sides. And then we orthogonalize them, but we can't undo that orthogonalization thing in any way, and therefore my conclusion is the NMTO is maximum. And this measure is orthogonalized. But I haven't seen anybody come up with any other measure, maybe U or whatever, which is better. So I actually believe that when it comes to the point, all of these things, chosen things have gotten along with the same so much. Okay, but now I want to say a little bit here. I'm saying, but of course, expanding the low energy basis to include also the oxygen ball is going to small bands, you're going to, of course, localize things more. Now you can say, well, that's not in the rule of the game. Are allowed to do that. Let me come in a little thing on that. So let me now go. So what I said here was a discussion of localization, orthogonalization, and a unitary transformations. Now I want to get to the other point. With these NMTOs, what we are really considering are overlapping band situations. I don't know whether you can see this, you cannot. There are many cases where you do not have a non-overlapping situation. Lorentz, as I said, the picture. Lorentz had an orbital which looked very much like the one I showed you. His bandwidth was a few millivolts or whatever. This is in the high CC situation, minus 6 volts, plus 4 volts. This is 10 volts. And the band I'm interested in this one here. So, because of this sharing of the oxygen situation like this. Now you can see there is no, although this is an LDA calculation, and we believe that the band we're interested in is this so-called anti-bonding, so there's this anti-bonding and the bonding down here, cover oxygen thing. But you can see in a case-based method, if you were trying to project out the block functions. You have to sit at each k point and decide which of these bands are you going to take down here. And I would say, I don't care. Because the chemical, what we know, the physics of these systems is it doesn't matter what all the spaghetti is down here. Somehow we know that this doesn't influence the physical properties. The thermal level is up here, and there are other terms in the Hamiltonian, which makes it anti-ferromagnetic, and so on and so on. But we cannot, or we believe, or I could get back to this, maybe that it matters what it does here, because these things are very different from one ICC to the other. So what we believe, this is now getting me from the concepts of the Banyo orbital into a low energy orbital. But I would say, well, coming from the field, I would like to get orbitals to give a good representation of the band, and that's what this blue line does. The line, the blue line, is the band you obtain by using the orbital I showed you variationally and calculate the energy. And this is what I would like to have. It is not unique because things depend maybe on what it is here. What I told it is to be cover x square minus y square character. And I told it to be the right band structure for these two energy points in them. So the orbital, what it does down here, it has to go, there is a pure x, because the symmetry is like that, a pure x square minus y square state down here. Apart from that, so it has to go down to this. But in the details of how it does it, I would say, well, I would probably choose the orbital so that it does this in the smoothest way. Because, you may remember, I'll get back to this, the chemistry of this is it's a three-band situation. There's this antibonding, and there's an oxygen band here, and there's the other band down here, and for a certain combination, if it's P is equal to ED, then this thing would be a cusp. And then the Hopping intervals and so on would have absolutely long range, and I don't think that matters. The method can do it. I mean, we can fill it here in this case for the calcium carboxide. You can just, you see, in calcium carboxide, it turns out that the ED is here, and EP is above ED in the band calculation. So the band itself connects onto this point, but the symmetry would have connected here. There's this inversion. I can force my method to make a jump. This orbital that you have that goes down here makes this jump. You can use it variationally. But I do not believe that the physical properties reflect this in any way. And if they reflect this, then I would say we have to go to a three-band situation. Then this thing, whether EP is higher or lower than ED and all of that, that can only be done in a three-band case and not with a one-band. So I would say this is a real case where there's one band, and if you believe we can get away with doing a one-band Hamiltonian, then there's no way of doing the Banyo function. You can make a sensible choice like the ones I've shown you to get a low energy orbital, and that's it. But there's no way of doing the thing unless you get long range or all kinds of things. Okay. What Well, I just to begin, Alan, say that we have done now, there is a way, but it's not that easy to get the Hopping intervals out of this, because you can see, depending on how you do this continuation of that band over here, the Fourier transform of this band will have shorter or longer range. So you have to make a Fourier transform, which is good around in the neighborhood of where the Fermi level is, and outside it simply is as smooth as possible. But there, but looking at three-band models and so on, and these things, you come up with this. And this is now that there's one parameter which determines, which this is basically T prime over T. It gives the range of the Hopping, but if you want to do the same fine, then there's a whole serious expansion in this R which tells you what successive Hopping intervals is. But this could be and down here, I've transformed it to TPP, which you can three-band model, so this, each of these now dots is now a family of high TCs, and here I put out the Hopping interval versus the measured TC max. What you're supposed to see that there's a certain correlation between these guys and the TC max. I will not get into the details with this. I'm giving this talk off and off. I'm giving it again. I'm just trying to say a lot of these Hopping intervals that we can calculate in difficult situations like this. Because you know these tight CCs are horrible things. They have many acids figuring itself, and figure out the thing requires a certain care. Even in the Hopping intervals, which for isolated bands would be unique, it's just a Fourier transform in this case because of this overlapping nature. It is not that much. Okay, so to the U now. How unique are the U's? I tried to tell you that this orbital, I don't think we can do much
localize it much more, do much better to it. So the charges on this thing is sort of 45% on the copper and 10% on the oxygens, and there are four of them, and the rest sit out here. And this is very similar to what I believe Warren showed, and therefore, if one day we will calculate this with bare U for this guy, actually, we will, of course, get this thing is even more localized than the atom. So if I put one electron, not 45% on this guy, I would probably get 30 volts, something like that. It's a huge thing. But since there is only half, or say half on it, I'm going to multiply that by a quarter. And then I'm down, and then these things out. So the U of this thing will be like Warren's U, 6 volts or something like that. We'll calculate the bare U without screening with the conduction band and the valence band, as I showed you this morning. Okay, and so the message is here, I don't think this little halo sitting out there, if you change them a little bit, changes much in the U. If you calculate U for the orthogonal or the non-orthogonal, just to give you some feeling for it, they're not going to be that different, I think, that they're used. This is just the charge density pi squared on this thing. So this is a central copper sphere, and this is oxygen. I'm just going through it from copper through oxygen to the next copper over here and so on. And you see if you square the function, you know most of it sits down here. So I would believe that for the value of U, it doesn't matter too much what you have up here. But you need to calculate it, you need to screen it, and you can see the screening is, of course, going to be unusual, yes, because in the screening bands, the valence band and the conduction band, their orbitals also sitting here. Things are not very well separated if you use it. One band part of the
substance. So when you calculate this fully transformed to get the hoppings, I mean, how far you have to go?
Well, it depends on how you connect, how you finish that band. If you finish with a kink, you have to go to the moon.
Okay. But usually for this supercomputer.
No, but you can't, you know, and then it hybridizes to the real band, and it'll avoid you crossings and this and that. You'll never convert, but you sort of have to. Well, what I wanted to say is this trend that I said in the height CCs is this is a height CC one layer thing, and that's Lanzmann. It's seen perpendicular to the plane. The other picture was up in the plane. And what determines this, or what gave this correlation I showed you, is simply the charge Lanzmann. You gave that apical oxygen and Lanzmann and so on. You have a lot sitting out here. Whereas in the higher CCs, you remove the weight because you turn from the chemistry and the distances out here, and there's actually nothing here, and that weight sits inside the plane. That is this thing. However, if you want to understand this chemistry, or if you say that this orbital I showed you is too disconnected, I'm coming back to what Warren said, that orbital picture, there's not much coherence in these little things sitting out here. And also I showed you that it is this kink, and the kink, if you really believe that the things that far away in energy have anything to say, maybe they do, after all, U is big, so why shouldn't something happening a few volts away have some meaning? Then we should break this thing up and at least have a three orbital model. So this is now a different game. So here we can, of course, take our LNTOs. This is now for lanthanum again, and this is for the single layer mercury. And you can, of course, give your method three bands, three orbitals, this one and that oxygen on the x square minus y squared, and demand that they reproduce the shape, these are now the stable blue ones, of the conduction band, well, and not care about what they do down here. So there are three bands, a non-bonding and a bonding one here, but simply demand that they are as localized as possible. Now, this demanding they are localized as possible, that is simply what Sanusri does. This is a 3x3 matrix, and you Fourier transform it and look at it, and it looks too long-ranged. Then you go and turn up these A radii, and you do something again. But there isn't that much you can do. So now the chemistry, which I said was sitting out in these tails, the chemistry is, of course, now all out in the oxygen orbitals. So what I'm trying to say is here's lanthanum. That is a copper. This is copper on the next one. That is a copper orbital of this three-band model. That thing is very localized. It doesn't have any of this stuff here, and it doesn't hop to anything. That's a flat level. This thing has no hopping intervals to the others. The oxygen orbital, however, couples has little halos on the copper side and on these pi things sitting up here. If you see it from the side, comes this chemistry thing out,
This is the oxygen orbital perpendicular to the plane, and here you see the halos of an apical oxygen and lanthanum and so on. But a model like this, with three orbitals, would sort of put the chemistry into, if you're not going to put U's or not a big U's on the oxygen, you put the chemistry out in the Anderson impurity Hamiltonian and land out in non-correlated orbitals, and it would separate the X square minus Y square orbital. I don't know, this is just a possibility. I would like to show you now the Mercury one. This is the lanthanum, that is a Mercury, and you see the Mercury again, as I said, doesn't have this stuff here, so that the hopping integrals from this one onto the next one, which goes via this thing, that is these TPP integrals, would be different. So it's the same trend as the one I showed you before, it's the seven put onto some other orbits. Yeah.
This seems to be suggesting that the optimal orbital is energy dependent. If you want to look at high energy properties, photo emission and so forth.
Yeah, sure.
You might want to use the local orbital, the large U. With low energy properties, you have to deal with these more hybridized orbitals.
All the bands, I mean, CX and the photo emission and so on, there's all lots of bands. They just never show them on so on. They also depends on the surface and stuff like that. But they are there. So what I want to point out is with this machinery, we have flexibility. And I think one has to make the model for the properties we are interested in, and there are various knobs. But I believe that the phase of the Vanier function is not the knob which can achieve very much. These are the same.